Hi, everyone. I am Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. Weekend of Friday, August 24th. Hope you guys are having a great week. Coming up on Labor Day, gateway to fall and winter, unfortunately. But been a busy news cycle here in the past month. Seems like every day is crazy with news, all types of stuff happening. And this week was no different. We had SummerSlam that happened last Sunday and TakeOver the day before that. And helping me talk about some of the highlights from those shows and some of the key talking points, at least to me, is a good friend, old friend, Denny Burkholder from CBS Sports. Denny and I talked for about 30, 35 minutes about just that. Some of his key takeaways from TakeOver, as well as SummerSlam, Ronda Rousey, the weird eye makeup thing, and the match itself, I wasn't a big fan on, So we get into that, the whole, Braun Strowman cash-in, non-cash-in thing from Sunday and then from Monday in Raw, as well as Denny's recent feature on, I'm completely blanking, Randy Savage. Yeah, Randy Savage. He did a thing, a really cool thing. He talked to several wrestlers, peers of Randy Savage's back in, 30 years ago, Ted DiBiase and so on, Ricky Steamboat. Really with, Savage's, his big, SummerSlam moment and just really kind of what a buzz there was around him, 30 years ago. So Denny will talk about that. He told a lot of really cool stories too. One with, Ted DiBiase and Savage doing a double shot and a conversation on a plane that is, I thought was pretty awesome. And again, one of the reasons that we love, old pro wrestling stories. So without further ado, let's get right to it. Denny Burkholder of CBS Sports talking about SummerSlam TakeOver. And Randy Macho Man Savage. Oh, yeah. Well, it's been a while since our guest this week has been on our airwaves, and happy to welcome him back. He's he's actually one of our first round of guests, I believe. He is the one and only Denny Burkholder from CBS Sports. Does a lot of work over there across various sports, but pro wrestling never leaves too far from his heart. He just did a feature recently on Randy Savage, actually, which was pretty interesting going leading into SummerSlam. And Denny, we'll welcome you back, and I guess we'll ask you the obviously the real tough questions first. How's your fantasy football planning going, if you have a team at all?
Oh God, I'm down to two teams. I used to be up in the 5-team range, but I learned very quickly to my financial detriment that I could not successfully manage more than a couple of teams at a time and expect to win any money. But I'm down to two teams. I'm doing absolutely terrible at planning this year. But I won one of my two leagues last year. So hopefully, things are looking up.
Yeah, I'm down to three teams. Three teams is pretty much my max. After that, it just gets me too crazy. And of course, everyone gets asked to play in seems like 10, 12 different leagues. But three with three different pockets of friends seems to work okay. And I'm in like a pick 'em pool and all that stuff. But I also I take fantasy baseball way more serious than the fantasy football, just because it's a I'm in a group. It's a little bit more competitive league, and we've been doing it for like 10 plus years now. But fantasy football, my research usually is listening actually to the CBS Sports fantasy football podcast, just kind of catching up on the different positions and position by position previews and all of that, and just kind of doing like some last second stuff. And I always seem to do well, but I'm always that guy that has an awesome regular season, makes it to the postseason, and then gets bounced in like the first round, you know?
Yeah, and my thing traditionally was that I was the guy who was really, really good at drafting, so I'd go undefeated for like 7 weeks.
Yeah.
But I was so bad at replacing guys that got injured or whatever that by the last part of the season, I would find my way out of the playoffs.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's an affliction that that all of us at play definitely run into. I wanted to, let's kick off. Again, it's been a while since we last talked to you. I wanted to ask about this this Randy Savage piece, because it's interesting. Obviously, Randy Savage has passed away years ago, but you did kind of an interesting thing, and I love these aspects of these stories where you ask and people talk to some of the people around them about kind of what happened. And tell to everyone about your story for CBS Sports, The Summer of Savage.
So So it's been 30 years since Savage had his big first WWE world title run there in a few-month period when Hulk Hogan needed to take off and film No Holds Barred. I think maybe the only person that worked out well for him was Randy Savage. And so we kind of wanted to commemorate that. Plus, Savage is one of these amazing, like, timeless figures that for whatever reason, well, I mean, I shouldn't say for whatever reason. There are some very obvious reasons why people still love him. But people haven't forgotten. People still wear his T-shirts. And one of the things that kept coming up as I interviewed these guys, and when I write these features, especially if it's about somebody deceased, like when I did the Andre the Giant long form or mm-hmm. now this Randy Savage one, I can't talk to the person, obviously. So the best I can do is talk to the people who knew him, the people who saw them at their worst, saw them at their best, saw them when the camera lights went on, and see if we can maybe get some nuggets of information that hadn't trickled out yet, which is very difficult with somebody this famous. But one of the things that kept coming up from guys like Teddy DiBiase, Ricky Steamboat, Jake the Snake Roberts, is that they're frequently amazed by when they go to these Comic Cons or these autograph signings, these conventions, and, you know, they talk to a lot of longtime fans, and they'll see also these children or these teenagers walking around in Randy Savage gear, asking them about these old Randy Savage matches, and they're just very big fans who couldn't possibly have been alive the last time Savage had a big match, which is the wonderful thing about things like the WWE Network and YouTube, and, you know, people can kind of become a fan of something that they, you know, in decades past, you would have had a hard time even learning about. So Savage is one of those guys who's still very popular and still has, you know, a major place in wrestling history, and I decided to try to flesh out what that summer was like for him. Obviously, we know that he wrestled Ted DiBiase upwards of 60 times, 70 times one-on-one. There was the whole Mega Powers, Mega Bucks thing, which makes it even bigger because a lot of people regard that as one of the last truly great storylines, partially because it was rooted in real life. But I thought it came out okay. I talked to a lot of people who knew him, a lot of people. I tried to find people that you don't see interviewed often. Mm-hmm. That resulted in me getting a very interesting voicemail from Jesse the Body Ventura. He did not participate in the story, but I saved his voicemail. I was successful in finding him and reaching him. He was not interested in talking for my story. But I was hoping to talk to guys that weren't wrestlers that get interviewed five times a week on podcasts. I kind of succeeded, but, you know, I think the story came out okay.
So what was Jesse Ventura? So you reference him in the piece. Did he? So you were trying to get a hold of him. He was not interested. Can you give us a little taste of kind of what the tone was in that voicemail?
So Jesse is a very I don't know if batshit is the term, but he's one of those guys who's, you know, the conspiracy theory, and mm-hmm. he's very, very off the grid now. I think he was living in Mexico for a while, like he still isn't. He does things for Russia Today, and I think that's all he does, you know, media for now because of something that happened. So what happened was, it took me a long time to even figure out a way to reach him, because I don't think he has a cell phone or anything. And I finally figured out a way to reach him through a person who represented him. And it took me several tries to find that person, several follow-ups with that person to get them to, you know, needle Jesse and see if he'd participate. And I was asking nicely. I wasn't, you know, I understand when you're writing these types of stories, you're asking people for their time that don't have a lot of time. So you need to kind of approach it that way and be very respectful. Mm-hmm. And I get this call from a blocked number. I'm not in the habit of answering those types of calls because you never know. And it went to voicemail, and they left the voicemail, and I listened. And there is absolutely no way to mistake the voice of Jesse the Body Ventura, especially when you've watched wrestling as long as I have.
Yeah.
So I hear that voice, and I'll kind of paraphrase it. I don't remember exactly how I phrased it, but it was, yeah, hi, Benny, this is Jesse the Body Ventura returning your call. I know you've been trying to reach me through the story. Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen because as you know, I won my court case, and he's referencing the court case for, I forget the guy, he was sued for, he sued the guy for defamation, and the guy later died. And he won the case, but then the case got overturned on appeal. And Jesse, in his voicemail, said that since the media was responsible for getting his court case victory overturned, the only way he could fight back against the media is to stop doing media appearances and interviews. So he was calling to tell me he wasn't going to do my Randy Savage story interview for that reason, and that he only does media with like Russia Today now. He doesn't do United States media.
Wow. What a riot.
So the content of the voicemail was interesting, but then I also found it oddly polite of him to have called and explained why he wasn't going to talk. You know, most of the time, and I'm sure you know this, anybody who's done any number of interviews knows, if somebody's not going to talk to you, more often than not, they're just going to ignore your email, ignore your voicemail, and you're just never going to hear back from them one way or the other.
Yep.
He actually called back to explain to me why he didn't want to talk to me, which I thought was polite in a way.
Now, had you picked up that phone call, that would have been a very interesting conversation as he would try to explain this to you. And I mean, who knows? You could have been on the phone with him for like 2 hours.
You know, I consider myself a man of at least modest intelligence, but I don't think I would go toe-to-toe with Jesse the Body. I really don't think I would win that argument.
Yeah, you know, maybe for another day. Maybe when he comes off his media ban, which you know, I'm sure mainstream media is really being affected by his not talking. The former governor of Minnesota, very interesting stuff, huh? What was so in this? I think I asked you this when we talked about the Andre story. It was a couple of years ago. What was the one thing that you thought you knew going into this that you were surprised, or was there anything you were surprised to learn? Maybe a previous thing that you had held true, like, oh, this has to be a fact, and you kind of heard, this wasn't actually the case at all.
Well, you know, that's kind of what I go into these stories looking for. I mean, you'd like to think there's not a lot we don't know about Andre the Giant or Randy Savage anymore, but I went in with that mindset. Let's see if we can at least get a few things that haven't been covered. And I think the closest I came with Savage was Hacksaw Jim Duggan revealed that he used to play chess with Randy backstage. At the same time, he was one of many who admitted that Savage was very much to himself, him and Elizabeth. You know, the classic story of how they got their own dressing room. They would mostly stay in there unless they had to talk about a match or something, and they didn't really play cards. They didn't really socialize much. But Hacksaw admitted that from time to time, Savage was one of the only guys in the locker room that would actually play chess with him. And it's just interesting to me, number one, the visual is great. Number two, it's just interesting to me that the two guys in the locker room who played chess and stuff cards were Jim Duggan and Randy Savage.
My God, yeah.
But I thought that was fun. And then there's a very often told story about Savage liking to plan out his matches as he did with Ricky Steamboat for WrestleMania 3. I tried to take that a step further and see if he was quite that bad with Ted because, you know, he wrestled Ted so many times, plus that title reign at WrestleMania 4 was so huge for Savage's career. I was interested in hearing Ted's side of that. You know, did he sit down and try to give you a move breakdown? And he did, but Ted told a nice story about that, which is that, you know, Ted at some point during their conversation said, all right, look, Randy, I know you like to plan these things out, and I know your heart's in the right place. You're doing it to make sure the match is as good as it possibly can be. But hear me out. He's like, I'm not used to doing it this way. I'm used to calling it as I see it. And Ted explained, you know, in a live performance, whether it's wrestling or Broadway or whatever, you have to be able to react to how the crowd is reacting. And if you see something or hear something, it means that you should do more of this or less of that. You need to be able to respond to that and kind of go off script. He explained that to Randy and said, if I hear something or see something during the match and I think we need to go a different way, please give me the leeway that we will do what you will allow me to call an audible, and then we'll get right back to what you're planning here. And what Ted said was that Randy kind of looked at Elizabeth, and Elizabeth said, Randy, you can do that. And then Savage looked back at Ted and said, okay, brother, I can do that. And Ted thought that was funny that he kind of looked to Elizabeth and said, hey, am I capable of this? And Elizabeth kind of nudged him in the right direction. But then he also elaborated on, you know, the famous steel cage match from Madison Square Garden where the fan climbed the cage at the end of the match.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Ted about that day, and he said that, I mean, number one, it was a double shot. They did Sandgren and DiBiase in Baltimore that afternoon in a matinee. They whisked them away in a private jet from Baltimore to LaGuardia. And Ted told Randy, look, we can't plan this out as meticulously as we do every, you know, we don't have time to plan every move like you like to, because we just got here, lacing up the boots, shows in progress. And so they winged it. And he said that that was one of the first times where he was like, okay, Randy is really capable of having a great match without planning all this out. And as luck would have it, they were thrown a major curveball by right at the finish of the match. A fan climbed the cage, and you know, what do you do? You can't just shove the fan off the cage and then you get sued. But that was a little bit of the fun stuff that we got out of the guys we interviewed.
You can check out that story on best place to go is Denny's Twitter, Denny's Twitter handle, and it's pinned right to the top there. Denny Burkholder, and we'll go to give that handle a little bit later on. When you mentioned double shots, it is crazy now in 2018 to think of that happening. A main event in one city happening twice, that like in the same day. That is and I know it used to happen all the time. And I sit here in 2018, it's still crazy that they were able to pull that off.
It's incredible the schedule that those guys maintained. And I know that some of them catch a lot of flack for embellishing, but if you look at the actual statistics, it's still pretty crazy. There was something like 260, 270 matches a year for a couple of years there, 86, 87, that Savage had. They're documented. I mean, there's actual results and attendance. I mean, there's that's not embellishing, and that's a lot. And some of them were double shots, like we just discussed. So you got to figure these are all in different cities too. So even the days where he wasn't wrestling, chances are good he was flying or driving. It's a tough life, man.
Definitely. And speaking of tough lives, they're actually not really I wouldn't say really a tough life for someone like Ronda Rousey, obviously flying high right now. And we'll kind of get in a little bit about SummerSlam weekend and your overall thoughts. I'll start off with a hot take. I thought TakeOver was good, but I didn't think it was great. And it just wasn't bad, but it was, it was a tight show. It was usual TakeOver stuff, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I saw some people that really, really thought it was awesome, and I guess others thought it was okay. I thought it was good. What when you came out of TakeOver, what was your feeling?
I think it sounds like I liked it a little more than you did. I really liked TakeOver, and I think with TakeOver, they're at the point now where the matches are so consistently good that they're going into each event with a certain amount of equity for the fans, where people are coming into the show expecting to love it, which I think helps in terms of the public reaction. But I thought it was really, really good. I understand some of the criticism of the Gargano Ciampa match. There was a lot of greatest hits type stuff in there where they were kind of calling back to things that they'd already done. I can see the point of view that's repetitive. I kind of looked at it as a glass half full type situation where I appreciate the callbacks and the attention to things that had been done before. There's one way to take it, and that it might be, going back to the same spots a lot is lazy. I don't really look at it that way as far as this particular match goes. I think it was more so than in many feuds. Gargano Ciampa, they're paying attention to making sure that they're sticking to the storyline, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
They keep going back to the same old tricks. They keep calling for the same old things.
Yeah.
Which to me, I appreciate because I don't see that as much as I used to, and I miss it. Some of the matches you see, it's a string of moves. And even though the moves might be amazing and visually it's a great show, you could forget about it, a day later.
Yeah. I didn't, it's funny you mentioned that about the callback spots. That actually didn't bother me at all. I liked the main event. I liked their first match, the first TakeOver match they had of the series of three. That was my favorite of the three. I think that the way they transitioned that finish with the brace was just, I mean, that was just a moment. Oh my God. It's just, that was the best. I don't know. I guess. Yeah. And maybe it's to the point that these shows that kind of like you allude to that they're consistently so good that now we're just kind of waiting for, okay, you know, how does it get kicked up to another level again? And I'll be interested in kind of see, you know, this next round, how that happens. I think we were talking about this in our Slack channel, some of the editors, and about Ricochet. And he is amazingly talented. Obviously, there's no doubt about that. But there's something with his matches, I just don't get into them as much as I do with some other guys. It's almost like you're kind of waiting for the spots, but the in-between, for whatever reason, for me, doesn't really hook on yet. And I don't know if that's just I don't know if it's just a me thing. I don't know if it's just something with him that other people notice. What are you thinking about Ricochet? How does he make you feel?
I would agree with that. I do a lot. See, I watch these shows with my kids, and I have a 4-year-old and a 13-year-old, and one of them is a pretty big Ricochet fan. And I noticed that I watch Ricochet's matches in a lot of the same way that he does. And he kind of sits there and waits for the big moment. He waits for the spot. Like he's not really invested in the story so much. Like whether it really didn't matter if that was a title match or not to him. He's like, here's Ricochet, get ready for the flip, you know, get ready for the move. And I don't say that to downplay how amazing Ricochet is when he does these moves. That's part of the show. That's part of the entertainment. By all means, I mean, that belongs. That's a part of wrestling. But you are correct, and I kind of share your opinion, where the in-between, you feel yourself watching his matches in a different way than you watch a Gargano Ciampa. You're not invested in the story so much as you're here for the Cirque du Soleil. You know, you're here for the ooh and the ah. So yeah, I can see that. Some of that might be experience. Like after he gains a few years of experience, and maybe, I hate to say it, but maybe after a knee injury or two, like, you know, Rey Mysterio suffered after a while, and you might get forced to and use a little more psychology just to kind of preserve your health, and maybe his matches will change in a few years.
Yep. No, that's true. That's true. And maybe this is a case where, you know, there's always this discussion about why are these guys going to NXT instead of going to the main roster, and I think we kind of understand why that is. You know, maybe this is a case where a guy like Ricochet, he needs to be down there for, you know, a good year and a half to kind of figure that out, and maybe, you know, maybe that'll set him up for a little bit longer down there. Will set him up for a nice, you know, 10-year run, so to something like that in WWE. In the future. What other what are kind of key takeaways did you have? I'll mention one that one of our editors, Joe, had, is that he's convinced that Adam Cole is going to be a big star when he gets called up to the main roster at some point, that he just thinks he's a can't miss guy, and you know, obviously with NXT call-ups, we can see the can't miss guys sometimes do miss, and it's not their fault at all. What other key takeaways did you have from TakeOver?
As far as Adam Cole goes, I think what he's got going for him that a lot of guys are missing is he looks so comfortable as a top name. And Seth Rollins had that for a little while too when he was about to come up.
Yep.
He walks out on that stage like he truly and absolutely believes he's the main eventer. He never looks nervous. He just walks in that ring like he owns it. And I think that comes through on the television. For a TV product, I think, especially if you're maybe not the biggest guy, you're not a Braun Strowman, I think that helps you become a star. And for a long time, that was kind of the knock on AJ Styles. You know, he needs the charisma, he needs to talk better. But we all saw how that played out. Sometimes it just, you know, you cook the stew until it's done cooking, and not everybody develops at the same pace, I guess. But I think Adam Cole has the charisma. I'm not so sure how he'll mesh with certain guys on the main roster, but we'll see. I mean, I'm optimistic these days. So.
An optimistic wrestling fan, get out of here.
You know, I don't have a podcast, so I guess people don't catch me on my bad days as often as they do other wrestling writers. I'm one of the few people on earth that doesn't have a podcast, but I go on wrestling Twitter very regularly, and I see people getting angry about wrestling.
Yeah.
And I told my friend in our Slack channel the other day, I was like, you know, imagine spending your life being angry about pro wrestling. So I've been watching wrestling since like 1983. I'm not the youngest wrestling writer around, but I've been watching for a really long time. And there's things I think absolutely suck, and there's things that I think are absolutely wonderful. But imagine committing to the bad stuff to the point where you spend all day arguing about it on Twitter.
I'm
not above a negative comment on Twitter, but I try not to make it my focus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if something sucks. I mean, and the other thing is, it's episodic television. It's a show that never ends. The creative can evolve, and a lot of people have this this knee-jerk reaction that if something I don't like happened on SmackDown, such and such is buried, such and such is ruined. Very rarely is anybody completely ruined or buried, and I think Twitter loses sight of that sometimes.
A good example.
You know, they ruined Nakamura. They ruined Asuka. None of these people were ruined. Maybe last week could have gone better, but next week is another week.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier AJ Styles. If you remember when Chris Jericho beat him at WrestleMania and people were furious about that AJ was buried. I remember Jericho was actually, I believe, responding to people on Twitter afterwards. And it was a big thing. And now look at him. You know, he's been the champion for a year. Yeah.
Isn't it a shame how Jericho ruined Styles' career and Styles hasn't done anything since that? I mean, that's such a shame.
Yeah, it is. I kind of started to get a little bit more comfortable with this stuff and kind of how, and just to kind of let things, see how things go with, when I realized that, I think if we ask someone, do you remember what happened on Raw 1 year ago this week? Or if we asked this question in October, do you remember what happened on SmackDown 9 months ago? Most people will not be able to tell you what happened without looking it up. There's just that much stuff that goes on every week. And look, everyone gets frustrated by booking stuff or just things that don't make sense and, you know, and so on and so forth, the Roman Reigns thing. But I think that at some point, you know, there's so much that happens that you tend to forget what happened. And you're right. There's a chance that if someone's not getting the fair shake of things now where it appears that maybe in, you know, a month from now, that changes. And yeah, I think with Twitter kind of exacerbates the current as opposed to realizing that, look, you know, there's so much of this stuff happening every single week that if you don't like it, just wait a few weeks and it probably will change.
I mean, for how many years were we told that the B team were ruined and buried?
Right.
Now look at them.
Right.
I mean, things can change and things evolve, and it's not like a motion picture where the ending is the ending and that's what they did with it. I mean, this thing keeps going, and you know, some people have more faith in WWE creative than other people do, and that's totally fine. As viewers, we have that right. But I try not to lose faith, because eventually I like to believe that if people consistently and regularly see Becky Lynch getting cheered when she's supposed to be a heel, that they will eventually say, hey, maybe we ought to book towards the things that are making the crowd react that way, because it's fewer and farther between these days, and maybe we ought to do something to boost it up. I like to believe people have common sense. And even if the promo on SmackDown that she cut didn't make any sense, and I don't think it really did, I think it was kind of not the right direction to go, but I like to believe that the people in creative and the people backstage are watching, and they saw that, and the beauty of it is there's another SmackDown next week, and they have the ability to adjust. And I hope they will.
Well, speaking of WWE women talent, let's flip to Ronda Rousey. And my big takeaway, or one, a few takeaways from SummerSlam, and now we'll now as we just talked about being positive, we'll kind of flip to the negative. For me, anyway, I did not like that match at all. I'm fine with the squash approach, one sided approach. I get that. I think it started with the Ronda Rousey eye makeup. I don't know why they keep doing that. I don't know if it's her insistence. I don't know if it's someone in her camp or whatever, but it doesn't, it's not, not getting into look shaming everyone. It's not a flattering look for her. It looks strange. To me, like I like the additions that they did to her ring gear. They kind of, you know, they had the kind of gloves with the lines and they kind of played off the lines on the shorts and whatever. So I like that there was some, a little bit of advancement there. She went with an all black look. I think that was pretty cool. The eye makeup, I just don't think it does her any favors. It looks strange, and it looked weird. And then the match itself, I agree with the one-sided nature. I didn't like her talking so much throughout the whole thing. It felt off. It didn't feel like, it felt like she wasn't kind of focused. Like, you know, you're kind of presenting this talent as being this amazingly focused athlete. And in these past matches, she hasn't done this, but she's, you know, I know some people say she's calling out spots or whatever, but the way she was talking so much, it was distracting away from, to me, from what was happening. So I thought when she won, it didn't feel like a moment, maybe because it really wasn't to me like a big chase or she hadn't been screwed over before or anything like that. It didn't feel like kind of that, the thing of like, oh wow, she finally got it. It just felt like more of an inevitability as opposed to an emotional kind of ride that we were taken upon. So I didn't love the whole packaging of everything. And am I crazy here? What'd you think?
I pretty much agree with everything you just said. And I think I kind of chalked it up to, she was, with all the talking, she was basically over telegraphing a match that was already somewhat of a foregone conclusion. And I think that's one of the subtle things that maybe a wrestler learns with experience that she just doesn't have yet, which is, even if it's a quick match and it's a squash match and everybody knows and expects that you're going to win, it will come across as a better match if you at least let the fans believe that you take this challenge somewhat seriously. That doesn't mean you don't taunt. That just means, like, when you do something like pick your opponent up in a fireman's carry and then cut a 10-second promo before you complete the move, you're teetering on the edge of taking people out of that suspension of disbelief. I don't think anybody really seriously thought Alexa was going to come out of that match with the title, but still, you know, give us a little bit of drama for the few minutes you have in that ring. Don't come out cutting a promo already about the title you haven't won yet.
Yeah.
As far as the makeup goes, I agree with you there too. I didn't think it was a great look, but I kind of chalked it up to, I have this theory that somebody on the Glam Squad is a vinyl collector and recently got into 80s New Wave.
Yeah.
And because it seemed like we were going that direction. And to tell you the truth, it's cool looking. I like the look, but I feel like I feel like I'm wholly unqualified to discuss this topic, but as a human being with eyeballs, I felt like it was maybe a little extreme.
Yeah, the paint thing, I mean, Finn Balor, it works. It's part of this whole character. And you know, maybe if they had established this, like the, you know, the Rousey war paint, that this is something she was doing, or just so it's just some kind of seed plant. It just, I don't know. She's such a star on her own. And there's this look she has she's a celebrity and people kind of recognize her as such. So, to me, like, when they change that so much, it seems like, why would you do that? Let, you know, that this title win is going to be picked up by, and it was by all these major, you know, mainstream media outlets and so on. And, you know, that visual that you show is what people are going to see that aren't watching this. Right. So I just think that was kind of like, to me, I'm surprised I didn't kind of think ahead of that. It'd be like, do we want people's first thought to be like, okay, what's going on with her face, that she looks like a pro wrestler? Or what she's doing, as opposed to, this is Ronda Rousey, the person we knew from UFC and was the star and is now doing this. That disconnect was there. I'm surprised that wasn't more of a thing. Or maybe, look, maybe it was. And she was just like, no, I really want to do this. And they were just like, all right, we let the celebrity get what she wants. And there you go. So I'd be very curious to find out the backstory of that someday.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the way a performer looks is part of their brand, and Ronda Rousey is so unique in that she came into WWE so famous, having been on the covers of magazines and, you know, special documentaries and all this stuff, and obviously all the UFC experience, that her face is so recognizable that you almost are doing yourself and her a disservice to do extra stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, if that's, I don't know. It was an interesting choice, and it's somewhat different from a Finn Balor, like you said, because Balor, that whole demon makeup sells action figures, and I can tell you this because my kids have begged for the demon figure and kind of the Kinnicky look with the leather jacket they don't really care for. But so there's, especially with WWE, that's a part of it too. The more different cool looks you can have, then that's a new action figure Mattel could come out with in 8 months or whatever.
Yep, very true.
But, so maybe that played into it. I don't know.
Let's round the corner with this then. People talk the Roman stuff to death and the Brock stuff to death and what have you. Were you all right with how that whole thing turned out, and not necessarily the outcome, but just how they presented it?
Yeah, I felt like it was presented really smart, to tell you the truth, because I mean, everybody kind of expected that to maybe get a questionable crowd reaction. And WWE is in the business of presenting a TV show with as much excitement as possible. And like it or not, the crowd is a little bit of a prop in that respect. The crowd, you know, how the crowd responds becomes part of the show forever on the network and on YouTube or wherever. So if they really wanted an excited crowd for that match, and bringing Braun out for SummerSlam was for the main event, even if it was a false flag, was a pretty wise move on their part, I thought. And I got to say, from what happened the next night on Raw with the Shield and everything, as a kind of in a comedic way, I'm kind of interested in this sidebar storyline going on that suddenly Braun Strowman can't even instigate a match. It used to be nobody could beat him in a match, and now he can't even start one.
Right.
Because various people keep running down and stopping him. And, you know, the first night it wasn't somebody running down, it was Brock. But at the risk of getting Braun involved in a comedy storyline, I'm kind of amused by all that.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't like in the SummerSlam finish was I was confused as to, my thought was he was going to cash in at the end, and then, you know, Brock threw the case and then Braun was down, and I didn't really understand at what point he wasn't with that cash and was negated, and they just kind of like didn't really address it. It was like, okay, Roman Reigns wins, but I don't know, they kind of just like skip past that. So I'm saying they're thinking like, okay, is he not cashing in now? Is it because he's down, or is it because does he actually physically have to hand over the briefcase? Like, that was the one thing that just kind of took me out of it for a minute. Yeah, that was just kind of that was the only thing that just kind of took me out of it, and was like, I was like, what? I didn't really understand what was happening. That could have just been me, though.
Yeah, on Raw, I had a moment of, you know, what the hell? The reason that he's not able to cash in right now is as much about the referee as it is about the Shield, because the referee took the briefcase, and as they always do, they seem to completely blank out when somebody hands them a briefcase. It's like, well, who are you? What is this? What do I do with it? But come on, man, you're a referee in WWE. You know what a Money in the Bank is. Looks like you know what it means. You know the guy who handed it to you possesses it for a reason. Ring the damn bell. I don't know why these referees play out this whole, you know, mass confusion thing. Huh? What? You know, but the referee hands it to JoJo, who makes the announcement to the crowd, Braun is cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase. Why the bell didn't ring even before JoJo had the briefcase, I don't know. So to me, this whole, the Shield has cost Braun Strowman his chance to cash in the Money in the Bank. I mean, it was really kind of an unbelievable way to, in my opinion, to let Braun keep his shot despite the Shield interfering. The bell should have rang. Now, if the Shield was truly going to keep him from cashing in and he was going to keep the shot, then the Shield should have run down while the referee was standing there dumbfounded trying to figure out what this briefcase in his hand was.
Yeah,
but the fact that there was so much time between Braun handing the briefcase over and then JoJo makes the announcement, and then there's even more time before the music hits, it's like, you know, what else do you need to ring the bell?
I know. The dialogue with the referee is just, it is like, I get why they're doing it, because they're trying to draw it out and they're trying to get people to be like, just hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. But that after a while, you're right. It's like, this referee, they know what's going on, right? I mean, they just like, and there's like what this dialogue back and forth. What did they want people to think is happening there? Like, you know, is he trying to maybe dissuade him from cashing it? Like, there's just kind of this hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, and there's just so much delay in everything. It's it is kind of funny. That's kind of the real life aspect of it. You know, they would, you know, have some sort of new system or process or something like that. But of course, in pro wrestling, you know, all this stuff stays the same forever.
Yep, pretty much.
Well, before I let you go, I want to give you a chance to go ahead and plug social media and obviously, the Savage piece we talked about a little bit about, but anything else that's coming up where people can check you out and so on and so forth. Floor is yours.
Well, I am, I don't know how well known it is because I don't tweet about it that often, but I'm also a site production manager, for CBS Sports, handling NFL, NBA, NHL, so we're going to have a lot of coverage coming up. And that's also the reason why I write less frequently about pro wrestling than I used to. I'm just busy with some behind-the-scenes stuff. But you can always find me on Twitter, at Denny Burkholder. I have an Instagram, too, but I'm not very active there. It's at DennyB75. And I'm not sure when my next piece is coming out, but I will be sure to let people know.
And you're reading some books. You're reading, I was just flipping through this. I had not heard of this Death of the Territories book. I had heard of the Creating the Mania one. I've actually heard some pretty good things about that. But Death of the Territories, you're going to be checking that out by, it looks like, Tim Hornbaker?
Yes, and I flipped through it a little bit already. And nice thing about this particular author is a well-known wrestling historian. And you get just looking at the works cited at the back of the book tells me that it's going to be good because he does very thorough research and he points you to exactly what piece of, historical evidence he's discussing when he talks about this stuff, which is great because a lot of people have wildly varying opinions on what exactly caused the death of the territories and whether it was inevitable or whether Vince, singularly caused it. And it's nice that somebody wrote a book about it and is actually saying, here's all the different things that, that I'm referencing when I make this statement. So I'm really looking forward to reading it. If there is any chance that anybody is going to write a book about the death of the territories and include, information we don't know yet, it's probably a good shot that Tim did so. So.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to checking that out. I will also give a book recommendation, wrestling book related. It's something you may have read. I'm not sure. It just came out last month. Nitro, which is a book I'm actually holding in my hands by Guy Evans. It was a book basically about the rise of Nitro and kind of the history of WCW and how that kind of came to be with TNT. It is I'm about halfway through it. This is a big book. This is like a MMA encyclopedia, total MMA. If people don't know Jonathan Stone, this is like that size of book. It's huge. I'm about halfway through it. It's really good. It's well researched. It is he talks about 120 former TBS and WCW employees. I mean, he has talked to everyone. I think this is a lot different, obviously, than Brian Alvarez's Death of WCW book, but this is more someone that is, he's a fan of wrestling, but someone that kind of took a really like a journalistic approach to it and really just kind of well-researched all these different aspects and kind of going, it's chronological. So it's easy to follow along. Talks to Eric Bischoff extensively in it and talks again, all these people from behind the scenes with Turner and everything. It's fascinating. So if you have not read that, or if it's sitting on your shelf, I would definitely recommend that. And we're going to have Guy on in a few weeks here to talk about the book, but that's well recommended as well.
Yeah, I actually haven't checked that out yet, but you're not the first person that I've heard mention that it's very thorough. I'm intrigued and I'm definitely going to have to check that one out too.
Awesome. Great. Denny Burkholder, thanks so much for stopping by and keep the positivity of a lot. Yeah. I'll try to try that again. Keep the positivity alive on Twitter and try to say it better than I did.
All right, man. Thanks.
All right, big thanks to Denny Burkholder for dropping by. You can follow him on Twitter, DennyBurkholder. And we didn't actually talk about all the old pro wrestling posters and all this other cool stuff he randomly tweets out from the past. And I forgot to ask him why he started doing that and how he gets some of this stuff. So we'll have to have him on again to talk about that. And I'm very intrigued. Check out this Death of Territories book. I had no idea this was coming out. I want to check that out. Again, Nitro, I am reading right now and about halfway through it. It is a thick read. As far as just like total pages, I mean, the physical book is a weight, man. It's huge. It's so, I think it's like 580 pages of text, and it is, it's really good. So I'll leave it at that. We're talking to Guy Evans here in a few weeks once I'm done the book and he can tell you all about it and, you know, why he started, why he wrote the book and all that good stuff. I am also on deck, set to read, I think it's called, I Think I Love You Pro Wrestling, or I Love You Pro Wrestling, by Jim Smallman, who is the owner and founder of Progress Wrestling. I got sent that book the other day. So once I'm done this book, I'm going to move on to that, and then we'll have Jim on at some point to talk about that. And then who knows, maybe Tim Hornbaker once I get to that book as well. So yeah, a lot of cool stuff coming up. Let's see, what else is coming up this weekend? UFC. We didn't talk anything about MMA this week, but let's get to it right now. So UFC happening on Saturday night in Lincoln, Nebraska, headlined by a very interesting lightweight fight between James Vick and Mr. Entertainment, Justin Gaethje. And this is a, you know, pretty interesting card, Fox Sports 1 card, and it's got interesting names, a lot of kind of, you know, crossroad fights in a lot of ways. Michael Johnson taking on Andre Feely in the co-main. Courtney Casey, Angela Hill, Jake Ellenberger, Brian Barberina. That's a crossroads fight for sure, especially for Ellenberger. John Moraga, who's a continual flyweight contender, former flyweight title challenger, and has kind of found himself in this gatekeeper role, kind of stuck in the middle of the rankings. He's on the show as well. Also, Eric Anders, big prospect. Someone we talked about several months ago when he took on Machida in a fight that we just thought was a little bit too soon. He did, I think, kind of get screwed out of the decision there against Machida, but hopefully he can get some momentum back against Tim Williams, who I know absolutely nothing about. So hopefully Anderson gets some momentum back. He's an interesting fella, has a great look to him, and hits really hard. And we'll see, we'll see what happens after this this Machida loss. So that'll be interesting. James Krause, Worley Alves, Izzy Alcantara, Mickey Gall opening up the FS2 prelims. I think originally he was scheduled to open up the Fight Pass prelims, so I'm glad they kind of came in their senses there. But yeah, Mickey Gall taking on George Sullivan, Joanne Calderwood, Drew Dober's on the show as well. So a lot of interesting talent up and down the roster. You know, not necessarily a must-see, but I think for, hardcores or a little bit level up from the hardcores, I think there'll be a lot to be interested in on Saturday night in Lincoln, Nebraska. And that leads us to, in a few weeks, actually, is it 2 weeks? Woodley versus Till, 228, September 8th. So, yeah, that's coming up pretty quick as well. I was amazed at that that press conference they did a few weeks ago, the big one where they announced McGregor and Khabib, is that Darren Till is enormous compared to Tyron Woodley, like towers over him. So that'll be interesting. We'll talk about that a little bit later on, but I thought that was I thought that was fascinating. And so this weekend show should be a lot of fun, and that'll do it. Big thanks to Denny Burkholder. Thanks to all of you for listening. You have a lot of choices in your podcast day, so we greatly appreciate you stopping by this show or any other show on the Wrestling Observer Podcast Network. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.